chapter 11. Says, but as he has naturally the finest ear for music ever known. Semicolon, what evidences of slavery, in a word, are there? It is the condition of the young lady's existence. She breakfasts at 8, she does angels questions with the governess till 10, she practices till 1, she walks in the square with bars round her till 2, then she practices again, then she sews her hems, or reads French, or Hume's history, then she comes down to play to Papa, because he likes music, whilst he is asleep after dinner, and then it is bedtime, and the morrow is another day with what are called the same duties to be gone through. A friend of mine went to call at a nobleman's house the other day, and one of the young ladies of the house came into the room with a tray on her head. This tray was to give Lady Maria a graceful carriage. Mon Dieu! And who knows, but at that moment Lady Belle was at work with a pair of her dumb namesakes, and Lady Sophie lying flat on a stretching board. I could write whole articles on this theme, but peace, we are keeping Mrs. Walker waiting all the while. Well then, if the above disquisitions have anything to do with the story, as no doubt they have, I wish it to be understood that, during her husband's absence, and her own solitary confinement, Mrs. Howard Walker bestowed a prodigious quantity of her time and energy on the cultivation of her musical talent. And having, as before stated, a very fine loud voice, speedily attained no ordinary skill in the use of it. She first had for teacher little Podmore, the fat chorus master at Ewell's, and who had taught her mother the tink-a-tink song which has been such a favorite since it first appeared. He grounded her well, and bade her eschew the singing of all those Eagle Tavern ballads in which her heart formerly delighted. And when he had brought her to a certain point of skill, the honest little chorus master said she should have a still better instructor, and wrote a note to Captain Walker enclosing his own little account, speaking in terms of the most flattering encomium of his lady's progress, and recommending that she should take lessons of the celebrated Borowski. Captain Walker dismissed Podmore then, and engaged Signor Borowski, at a vast expense, as he did not fail to tell his wife. In fact, he owed Bereskai no less than 220 guineas, when he was but we are advancing matters. Little Bereskai is the author of the opera of Liagabolo, of the oratorio of Urgatorio, which made such an immense sensation, of songs and ballet musics innumerable. He is a German by birth, and shows such an outrageous partiality for pork and sausages, and attends a church so constantly, that I am sure there cannot be any foundation in the story that he is a member of the ancient religion. He is a fat little man, with a hooked nose and jetty whiskers, and coal black shining eyes, and plenty of rings and jewels on his fingers, and about his person, and a very considerable portion of his shirt sleeves turned over his coat to take the air. His great hands, which can sprawl over half a piano, and produce those effects on the instrument for which he is celebrated, are encased in lemon-colored kids, new, or cleaned daily. Parenthetically, let us ask why so many men, with coarse red wrists and big hands, persist in the white kid glove and wristband system? Borowski's gloves alone must cost him a little fortune. Only he says with a leer, when asked the question, get along with you. Don't you know dear is a gloveress, that lets me have them very sheep? He rides in the park, has splendid lodgings in Dover Street, and is a member of the Egent Club, where he is a great source of amusement to the members, to whom he tells astonishing stories of his successes with the ladies, and for whom he has always play and opera tickets in store. His eye glistens and his little heart beats when a lord speaks to him, and he has been known to spend large sums of money in giving treats to young sprigs of fashion at Richmond and elsewhere. And my politics, he says, I am conservative to the backbone. In fine, he is a puppy, and with all a man of considerable genius in his profession. This gentleman, then, undertook to complete the musical education of Mrs. Walker. He expressed himself at once enchanted with her gay abilities, found that the extent of her voice was prodigious, and guaranteed that she should become a first-rate singer. The pupil was apt, the master was exceedingly skillful, and, accordingly, Mrs. Walker's progress was very remarkable. Although, for her part, honest Mrs. Crump, who used to attend her daughter's lessons, would grumble not a little at the new system, and the endless exercises which she, Morgina, was made to go through. It was very different in her time, she said. Inkledon knew no music, and who could sing so well now? Give her a good English ballad. It was a thousand times sweeter than Erigaro's and Emiramite's. In spite of these objections, however, and with amazing perseverance and cheerfulness, Mrs. Walker pursued the method of study pointed out to her by her master. As soon as her husband went to the city in the morning, her operations began. If he remained away at dinner, her labors still continued. Nor is it necessary for me to particularize her course of study, nor, indeed, possible. For, between ourselves, none of the male Fitzpoodles ever could sing a note, and the jargon of scales and solfeggios is quite unknown to me. But as no man can have seen persons addicted to music without remarking the prodigious energies they display in the pursuit, as there is no father of daughters, however ignorant, but is aware of the piano rattling and voice exercising which go on in his house from morning till night, so let all fancy, without further inquiry, how the heroine of our story was at this stage of her existence occupied. Walker was delighted with her progress, and did everything but pay Borowski, her instructor. We know why he didn't pay. It was his nature not to pay bills, except on extreme compulsion. But why did not Beresky employ that extreme compulsion? Because, if he had received his money, he would have lost his pupil, and because he loved his pupil more than money. Rather than lose her, he would have given her a guinea as well as her catchet. He would sometimes disappoint a great personage, but he never missed his attendance on her. And the truth must out, that he was in love with her, as Woolsey and Eglanton had been before. By the immortal Jove, he would say, that little ding sends me mad vid or big ice. But only vade vile. In 6 weeks I can bring any woman in England on her knees to me, and you shall see that I will, do vid my Morgina. He attended her for 6 weeks punctually, and yet Morgina was never brought down on her knees. He exhausted his best stock of emoluments, and she never seemed disposed to receive them with anything but laughter. And, as a matter of course, he only grew more infatuated with the lovely creature who was so provokingly good-humored, and so laughingly cruel. Benjamin Beresky was one of the chief ornaments of the musical profession in London. He charged a guinea for a lesson of 3/4 of an hour abroad, and he had, furthermore, a school at his own residence, where pupils assembled in considerable numbers, and of that curious mixed kind which those may see who frequent these places of instruction. There were very innocent young ladies with their mamas, who would hurry them off trembling to the farther corner of the room, when certain doubtful professional characters made their appearance. There was Miss Grigg, who sang at the Oundling, and Mr. Johnson, who sang at the Eagle Tavern, and Madame Fioravant I, a very doubtful character, who sang nowhere, but was always coming out at the Italian Opera. There was Lumley Limpeter, Lord Tweedledale's son, one of the most accomplished tenors in town, and who, we have heard, sings with the professionals at 100 concerts. And with him, too, was Captain Guzzard, of the Guards, with his tremendous bass voice, which all the world declared to be as fine as Porto's, and who shared the applause of Borowski's school with Mr. Bulger, the dentist of Sackville Street, who neglected his ivory and gold plates for his voice, as every unfortunate individual will do who is bitten by the music mania. Then among the ladies there were a half score of dubious pale governesses, and professionals with turned frocks and lank damp bandeau of hair under shabby little bonnets. Luckless creatures these, who were parting with their poor little store of half guineas, to be enabled to say they were pupils of Signor Borowski, and so get pupils of their own among the British youths, or employment in the choruses of the theatres. The prima donna of the little company was Amelia Larkins, Borowski's own articled pupil, on whose future reputation the eminent master staked his own, whose profits he was to share, and whom he had farmed, to this end, from her father, a most respectable sheriff's officer's assistant, and now, by his daughter's exertions, a considerable capitalist. Amelia is blonde and blue-eyed. Her complexion is as bright as snow, her ringlets of the color of straw, her figure, but why describe her figure? Has not all the world seen her at the Theatres Royal, and in America under the name of Miss Ligonier? Until Mrs. Walker arrived, Miss Larkins was the undisputed princess of the Bereskai Company, the Semiramide, the Racina, the Tamina, the Donna Anna. Bereskai vaunted her everywhere as the great rising genius of the day, bade Catalan I look to her laurels, and questioned whether Miss Stevens could sing a ballad like his pupil. Mrs. Howard Walker arrived, and created, on the first occasion, no small sensation. She improved, and the little society became speedily divided into Walkerites and Larkinsians. And between these two ladies, as indeed between Guzzard and Bulger before mentioned, between Miss Brunk and Miss Horseman, the two contraltos, and between the chorus singers, after their kind, a great rivalry arose. Larkins was certainly the better singer, but could her straw-colored curls and dumpy high-shouldered figure bear any comparison with the jetty ringlets and stately form of Morgiana? Did not Mrs. Walker, too, come to the music lesson in her carriage, and with a black velvet gown and cashmere shawl, while poor Larkins meekly stepped from Bell Yard, Temple Bar, in an old print gown and clogs, which she left in the hall? "Arkins sing," said Mrs. Crump, sarcastically. "I'm sure she ought. Her mouth's big enough to sing a duet." Poor Larkins had no one to make epigrams in her behoof. Her mother was at home tending the younger ones, her father abroad following the duties of his profession. As he had but one protector, as she thought, and that one was Borowski. Mrs. Crump did not fail to tell Lumley Limpeter of her own former triumphs, and to sing him Tink a Tink, which we have previously heard, and to state how in former days as he had been called the Ravenswing. And Lumley, on this hint, made a poem, in which he compared Morgiana's hair to the plumage of the raven's wing, and Larkinissa's to that of the canary, by which two names the ladies began soon to be known in the school. Ere long the flight of the raven's wing became evidently stronger, whereas that of the canary was seen evidently to droop. When Morgiana sang, all the room would cry, "Bravo!" When Amelia performed, scarce a H, and was raised for applause of her, except Morgiana's own, and that the Larkins's thought was lifted in odious triumph, rather than in sympathy, for Miss 50 was of an envious turn, and little understood the generosity of her rival. At last, one day, the crowning victory of the Ravenswing came. In the trio of Borowski's own opera of L'Agabello, Rosy Lips and Rosy Wine, Miss Larkins, who was evidently unwell, was taking the part of the English captive, which as he had sung in public concerts before royal dukes, and with considerable applause, and, from some reason, performed it so ill, that Borowski, slapping down the music on the piano in a fury, cried, "Mrs. Howard Walker, as Miss Larkins cannot sing today, will you favor us by taking the part of Bodicetta?" Mrs. Walker got up smilingly. To obey the triumph was too great to be withstood. And, as she advanced to the piano, Miss Larkins looked wildly at her, and stood silent for a while, and, at last, shrieked out, "Benjamin!" in a tone of extreme agony, and dropped fainting down on the ground. Benjamin looked extremely red, it must be confessed, at being thus called by what we shall denominate his Christian name, and Limpeter looked round at Guzzard, and Miss Brunk nudged Miss Horseman, and the lesson concluded rather abruptly that day, for Miss Larkins was carried off to the next room, laid on the couch, and sprinkled with water. Good-natured Morgiana insisted that her mother should take Miss Larkins to Bell Yard in her carriage, and went herself home on foot, but I don't know that this piece of kindness prevented Larkins from hating her. I should doubt if it did. Hearing so much of his wife's skill as a singer, the astute Captain Walker determined to take advantage of it for the purpose of increasing his connection. He had Lumley Limpeter at his house before long, which was, indeed, no great matter, for honest Lum would go anywhere for a good dinner and an opportunity to show off his voice afterwards, and Lumley was begged to bring any more clerks in the treasury of his acquaintance. Captain Guzzard was invited, and any officers of the guards whom he might choose to bring. Bulger received occasional cards. In a word, and after a short time, Mrs. Howard Walker's musical parties began to be considerably suvies. Her husband had the satisfaction to see his rooms filled by many great personages, and once or twice in return, indeed, whenever she was wanted, or when people could not afford to hire the first singers, she was asked to parties elsewhere, and treated with that killing civility which our English aristocracy knows how to bestow on artists. Clever and wise aristocracy! It is sweet to mark your ways, and study your commerce with inferior men. I was just going to commence a tirade regarding the aristocracy here, and to rage against that cool assumption of superiority which distinguishes their lordships' commerce with artists of all sorts. That politeness which, if it condescends to receive artists at all, takes care to have them all together, so that there can be no mistake about their rank, that august patronage of art which rewards it with a silly flourish of knighthood, to be sure, but takes care to exclude it from any contact with its betters in society. I was, I say, just going to commence a tirade against the aristocracy for excluding artists from their company, and to be extremely satirical upon them, for instance, for not receiving my friend Morgina, when it suddenly came into my head to ask, was Mrs. Walker fit to move in the best society? To which query it must humbly be replied, that she was not. Her education was not such as to make her quite the equal of Baker Street. She was a kind, honest, and clever creature, but, it must be confessed, not refined. Wherever she went, she had, if not the finest, at any rate the most showy gown in the room. Her ornaments were the biggest, her hats, toques, berets, marabouts, and other follows, always the most conspicuous. She drops s here and there. I have seen her eat peas with a knife, and Walker, scowling on the opposite side of the table, striving in vain to catch her eye, and I shall never forget Lady Smigsmack's horror when she asked for porter at dinner at Richmond, and began to drink it out of the pewter pot. It was a fine sight. She lifted up the tankard with one of the finest arms, covered with the biggest bracelets ever seen, and had a bird of paradise on her head, that curled round the pewter disc of the pot as she raised it, like a halo. These peculiarities she had, and has still. She is best away from the genteel world, that is the fact. When she says, that the weather is so hot, that it is quite debilitating. When she laughs, when she hits her neighbor at dinner on the side of the waistcoat, as she will, if he should say anything that amuses her, she does what is perfectly natural and unaffected on her part, but what is not customarily done among polite persons, who can sneer at her odd manners and her vanity, but don't know the kindness, honesty, and simplicity which distinguish her. This point being admitted, it follows, of course, that the tirade against the aristocracy would, in the present instance, be out of place, so it shall be reserved for some other occasion. The Ravenswing was a person admirably disposed by nature to be happy. He had a disposition so kindly that any small attention would satisfy it, was pleased when alone, was delighted in a crowd, was charmed with a joke, however old, was always ready to laugh, to sing, to dance, or to be merry, was so tender-hearted that the smallest ballad would make her cry, and hence was supposed, by many persons, to be extremely affected, and by almost all to be a downright coquette. Several competitors for her favor presented themselves besides Borowski. Young dandies used to canter round her feet in the park, and might be seen haunting her doors in the mornings. The fashionable artist of the day made a drawing of her, which was engraved and sold in the shops. A copy of it was printed in a song, Black Eyed Maiden of Araby, the words by Desmond Mulligan Esquire, the music composed and dedicated to Mrs. Howard Walker, by her most faithful and obliged servant, Benjamin Borowski. And at night her opera box was full. Her opera box? Yes, the heiress of the bootjack actually had an opera box, and some of the most fashionable manhood of London attended it. Now, in fact, was the time of her greatest prosperity, and her husband gathering these fashionable characters about him, extended his gentry considerably, and began to thank his stars that he had married a woman who was as good as a fortune to him. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.